You're listening to
Sex Gets Real.
Sex Gets Real.
Sex Gets Real.
Sex Gets Real.
With Dawn Sarah.
With Dawn Sarah.
Thanks. Bye.
Hey everyone, I just want to remind you that if you aren't supporting the show on patreon.com/sexgetsreal, then you are going to miss the super extended awesome chat that Dylan and I are planning. So if you've been a longtime fan of the show, you will be hearing a smaller version of Dylan and I having a little reunion in the next couple of weeks, but we are going to have an expanded version for Patreon supporters. So make sure you head over there. You can pledge as little as a dollar, and that gets you a chance to not only participate in fun things like PJ parties and some exclusive clips, but also this chat that we are going to be having in the next couple of days. This week's episode is an interview with the incredible Jacqueline Friedman. The hour that we spend together is wonderful and intense and challenging and deep. We talk about stealthing, which has gotten a ton of press lately, which is removing a condom during intercourse without consent. We talk about commodity versus collaboration when it comes to sex and what centering the humanity of sex has changed in Jacqueline's life. We talk all about the myth of hookup culture on college campuses. And she has some really powerful things to say about sexual assault awareness and why awareness is no longer good enough. We talk about the failures of transformative justice, and she even challenges me on some of my views around people who commit sexual violence and what we need to be doing about that at a community level. And we wrap up talking about pleasure and how that can actually help us heal some of these really big, painful issues that we have. So I hope that you enjoy this chat. It was certainly fun and challenging and wonderful to record. So for those of you who don't know who Jacqueline Friedman is, Jacqueline is a writer, a speaker, and an activist, and creator of the hit books Yes Means Yes, Visions of Female Sexual Power and a World Without Rape, and also What You Really, Really Want, The Smart Girl's Shame-Free Guide to Sex and Safety. Both of those books I highly recommend. Her podcast, Unscrewed, is paving new paths to sexual liberation, and it was actually named one of the best sex podcasts by both Marie Claire and Esquire magazines. Jacqueline's work has popularized the yes means yes standard of sexual consent that is quickly becoming the standard in the law on so many college campuses. So she is deep in this work. And her insistence that authentic sexual liberation is a necessary condition to end the systemic sexualization and violation of women led Lynn Michael Brown to actually call Jacqueline this generation's version of Dr. Ruth. There's so much more that Jacqueline does, and you can check that out at sexgetsreal.com/EP159 for this episode. It has links to several articles that we mention in this episode, as well as a link to Patreon so that you can support and hear that Dylan goodness that's coming up soon. Don't forget that this month's theme of May is food. So if you have confessions around ways food has played into your sexual experiences, your fantasies, disappointments, breakups, or huge moments of surprise and celebration, I want to hear from you. So please also share those. Here we go with this week's episode. Welcome to the show, Jacqueline. I'm so excited to have you here.
I'm so thrilled to be here, Dawn. Thank you for inviting me.
Ah, you're so welcome. I have long admired your work And as the listeners just heard in your bio, the books that you've written, and I know you've got another one coming that we will be talking about a little bit later in the year. But I would love it if we could get started. For people who aren't familiar with you and your work, could you tell us a little bit about kind of your story and what brought you to talking about sexual assault and consent and all these like really juicy topics that are so relevant now?
Yeah, I mean, I like to say that I just am an activist as like a life orientation. You know, I found an essay I wrote in like the third grade when I was cleaning up my parents' basement that was about like how zoos are bad because all the animals are kept locked up in cages. So I've always had a change-making orientation, a strong sense of wanting to work on social justice issues. And when I got to college, you know, I sort of started, you know, adding a feminist flavor to that. I probably was a feminist before then, but didn't really use that language. And then junior year of college, I myself was sexually assaulted, and that really has a way of focusing the mind. So I cut my teeth in terms of sexual assault, anti-rape activism, on campus. Honestly, I started before I was a victim myself, but I certainly got a lot more committed after that and really cut my teeth on campus and kind of haven't stopped since. It's just continued to evolve. So I have taught self-defense, and I used to do a theater, a one woman, kind of educational theater program called The Yellow Dress, where you'd perform this show about dating violence and then facilitate conversations with high school students about it. I, I'm a writer. I have done poetry around sex and sexual assault, and it's sort of just always been something that I've cared about. And my thinking about it, I think, has evolved a lot as I've gone. And so in terms of talking about consent and pleasure and sexual liberation, you know, all of which I consider to be my project right now, it really has evolved over time as I've come to realize that in order to address sexual violence, we have to address just the base level ways that the sexual culture functions and all the institutions that create the sexual culture, and vice versa, right? I think there's a lot of conversations around sex and sexuality that want to wall themselves off from talking about sexual violence and just be quote unquote sex positive, right? And you can't have an actually sexually free culture without addressing sexual violence. So I think part of my mission, a big part of it right now, I see is making those two movements into one movement.
I love what you're saying about sex positivity and needing to talk about sexual violence and how we can't kind of turn a blind eye to the cultural soup that we're living in and all of these things around like hypermasculinity and toxic masculinity and rape culture that we've just all kind of grown up in. And I think you're so right that to kind of deny that part or even just to simply leave it out, one, doesn't help things at all, but two, actually makes it more challenging for all of us to be having these conversations on a regular basis. And I love that you kind of want to bring these two together so that they're not two separate entities, but they're all part of the same conversation.
Yeah, and each conversation can have a different emphasis. I'm not saying everybody has to do all things all the time, but it can be really alienating to people to try and enter a conversation about sex positivity that doesn't acknowledge that sex and sexuality has been a location of great pain and injury for a lot of us. And to not acknowledge or integrate that into conversations about what I really have embraced the phrase sexual liberation myself, because I feel like it more fully encompasses that idea, and that sex positivity, although I understand the intention with which it's used by a lot of people, I think the phrase itself sounds kind of cheerleadery in a way that even just the phrase I've heard from students on campuses saying like, oh, I didn't think sex positivity is for me because I haven't found that sex is particularly positive.
Yes, I've had several conversations along those same lines of where often sex positivity gets either twisted or misunderstood to mean like sex required, and kind of this expectation of being sexual. And so I really love sexual liberation. That to me not only leaves more space for different experiences of sex, but I also think that the liberation word allows us to include things like reproductive justice and racial justice in these conversations around sexuality.
Yeah, absolutely. It is intentionally a lot more political and intersectional. And it also outlines a project, right, that we should all be free. We should all be free to define our sexualities and run our sex lives in ways that work for us, as long as we're not hurting anyone else. And that is what I think a lot of people who are thoughtful mean when they say they're sex positive, but not everyone is thoughtful. And even those that are, I feel like the phrase, I think it does more harm than good some of the time.
Yeah. And I know one of the things that you mentioned you really like talking about is kind of centering humanity in sex. And, you know, I think that ties so beautifully to conversations around consent and all of us being ultimately liberated in kind of bodily autonomy and the sovereignty of our lives and our experiences. And like, we really have to be able to center that. And I'd love to hear more kind of about what centering humanity and sex has looked like for you.
For me personally, you mean?
Yeah.
Oh. I think that for me, it has largely meant getting off like the sexual Olympics train, right? Really getting to a place where I feel fully comfortable being like, actually, I prefer monogamy and I'm not that kinky and, you know, like a couple of kinks, but like I have a lot of people in the field would consider a fairly vanilla sex life. And I think that idea of vanilla-ness, it comes with stigma. And I think that there is this idea that we have to, that sort of gets wrapped up sometimes in the sex positivity narrative, that we have to, that you were kind of referring to when you were talking about like having sex is better than not having sex, right? Like that having the most outré or sort of society challenging sex is the best way to show how free you are. And that's a trap, right? That's what sexual liberation has been for me is just like a great relaxing, like a great feeling like I am here where I am. And I've been in other places throughout my life. And I probably will be in other places in relationship to sex in days and months and years to come, right? It's not a static thing, but that in moments where what I want seems more conventional, that's also okay. Right? Like, because the point is that we should be approaching sex as an interaction, a fairly intimate interaction with another human being, at least one other human being, right? And that that emphasis also, it wraps consent right up in it, right? That when we really think about sex as an intimate interaction with another fully equal, co-equal human being, of course you're going to want to make sure that they're into it, right? Like, of course you're going to do what it takes to make sure that everyone is getting their needs met and is having a good time and no one's being harmed. Because that's part of recognizing somebody's full humanity. You know, when I started out doing talks on campuses, I would focus, not exclusively, but more than I do now, on what are the rules on your campus and what are the laws say and that sort of thing. And I've really abandoned talking about that stuff almost entirely because, look, it's important for everyone to know what the rules and laws are because we have a right to know and it's good to know those things. But when I talk about consent, I'm really making a moral argument, right, mm-hmm. which is about recognizing that you're interacting with a fully co-equal human being, right? And that you have a responsibility, whether this is a stranger you just met 10 minutes ago or your spouse of decades, you have a responsibility to show up and pay attention and exhibit care for their well-being. And, you know, if you can't meet that baseline, then you're not in a place where you're ready to have partnered sex. And that's okay. Like, all of us are not in a place where we're in a particular moment ready to have partnered sex at different parts in our lives. If we're too drunk, or if we're in a bad emotional space, or if, you know, this could be all kinds of reasons. There should be no shame attached to that either. But that, I think that we, have you had Lisa Wade on your show to talk about American Hookup?
No.
Okay. So the sociologist Lisa Wade wrote a fantastic book called American Hookup, which is about the so-called hookup culture on US campuses. And she found a number of really interesting things, including the fact, and I've been saying this for years also, this isn't really news probably to you, but like, the hookup culture is bullshit in the sense that college students these days are not having more sex than my generation or the generation before did, right? Like, the idea that there's some new phenomenon happening on college campuses in terms of how much casual sex everyone is happening is just completely mythology. Although if you ask college students, they all believe in the myth. So they're all experiencing this peer pressure that's not even coming from their peers. It's coming from moral panic. But what they did find is because of that sort of feeling like everyone around them is having like a nonstop bacchanal, right? Yeah. No, it's not true, but there's a mass misperception about it, that there's this pressure to like not catch feelings at all about someone you're having sex with. And what Lisa Wade says in the book, which I quote this line because I could never do better than it, she says, she's like, we're human beings. We have feelings about breakfast, right? Like, how could you possibly have sex without having feelings, right? That's not a thing that humans do. It doesn't mean you want to marry the person or even, you know, see them again, but it means that we do want to treat each other with kindness, right? Like, that we do want to recognize each other's humanity. And along with that comes feelings and all kinds of stuff. And so moving from that transactional idea of sort of accomplishing or acquiring sex to really treating it as what it is, which is a really intimate collaboration.
I feel like that's a perfect jumping off point for something that's getting a lot of buzz right now. And I got two emails from folks about it. And I think that it's just like, oh, it's, I think it's wonderful for us to roll around in kind of with this framework that you've just created around like transaction versus collaboration and kind of exhibiting care. And so, I'm going to read the two emails and we can just roll around. So the first email came from Mimi and it says, Dawn, have you seen this article on stealthing? I find it to be an important topic. I have come across men who, although are not supremacist types as described in the articles, admit to doing this sort of thing. To say it upsets me when they can't see why it's not okay is an understatement. Thanks for your invaluable contribution. I'd love to hear your thoughts. And then another listener, Holly, wrote in about the exact same thing, saying, I've been seeing lots of stories this week about stealthing. It was in USA Today, HuffPo, the New York Post. And I find these articles useful because I never knew it had a name. I had a guy stealth me in college. It was a guy who I'd been dating for a month and we'd fucked a few times. So I thought he was cool. But then one night when I was riding him, he was wearing a condom. And when we switched positions and he came back inside me, I noticed it felt different. And I looked behind me and saw the condom on the sheets next to him. He had slipped it off when we changed positions without ever saying anything. I felt so uncomfortable that I made him drive me home. And luckily I knew the risks so that I could get checked, but we stopped dating and I've felt violated ever since. Is this a popular thing that boys are doing now? Thanks, Holly.
Oh, Holly.
Yeah, I know. So just in case listeners haven't heard, I will link to one of the stories on the Sex Gets Real episode for this, but stealthing is removing a condom during intercourse without consent or without talking to your partner about it.
You know, what's funny to me about this, and I just want to say to Holly, like, good for you for setting that super clear boundary. And it's perfectly reasonable that you felt violation. It's a profound violation. So I just want to acknowledge that up front. The weird thing to me, and I also have gotten an email this week from a listener to my podcast Unscrewed, who was like wanting me to talk about stealth things. So I'm probably just going to like play this clip for them. But, I talked about it on Dawn's show. The interesting thing to me is that this is suddenly a trend story, I think because somebody made up a name for it. I don't know that there's evidence. Have you seen evidence that this is actually a practice that's on the rise, or it's just that people are suddenly discovering it? Because men have been tampering with fucking condoms forever.
Yeah, I mean, I've had that experience myself. So,
have you?
I don't think that it's new. But I think that what's kind of triggered this influx of articles is that there's a particular group who has recently said, like, we practice this and we don't think there's anything wrong with it. And so now everyone's picking up the story and freaking out and being super pissed, as they should be. But I think, like, suddenly someone has kind of said, like, we do this thing, we don't see the problem. And now everybody's like, wow. And so now people kind of have a reason to talk about it.
Welcome to the age of Trump. Sorry, am I allowed to get political on your show?
Yes. Please do.
Okay. You know, I do think that there's a certain phenomenon that is happening right now that is making misogynist assholes feel emboldened. It doesn't seem that the timing is accidental that they should say, you know, we violate women and we're proud. You know, because that's who we elected to the White House.
Right.
So, I mean, look, I'm just going to say this straight up. I don't know whether there's legal precedent about this, although it seems clear to me that this is a form of sexual assault. That someone is doing something to your body, either without acquiring your consent or in express violation of boundaries you've set, right? If you said, I only want to have sex with you with a condom on, or I want you to put a condom on, and they say yes, and then they take it off. That is, again, ethically, which is the space that I operate from. It's a sexual assault. It's a profound violation. And there's nothing okay about it. And it's so crystal clear that it's a dominance display, right? Like, it's like, I can do to your body whatever I want, regardless of what you feel like, right? It's an active act of dehumanization, right? I know you want me to keep this condom on, but I'm taking it off. So I'm erasing you and what you want. That's what makes it such a profound violation, you know, let alone the risk of pregnancy and disease transmission and all of that stuff. It's a deliberate act of dehumanization.
Absolutely. I know, like, it makes me so angry, and you know, it's like, I can't imagine deciding that my pleasure is more important than someone else's entire life, right? Like, to do that,
I think it's actually worse than that, Dawn. Think the decision is, it pleases me to dehumanize this person.
Yeah.
Right. So it's not just this person's concerns about, you know, disease and pregnancy and whatever don't concern me. My pleasure is more important than them. But I think especially with the kind of guy who's going to say, we do this and we're not ashamed, right? Like, I a lot of rapists, I'm just going to say it, like, it's a feature and not a bug that they don't have consent.
Yeah.
So it's even beyond, I don't care, right? It's like, that's appealing to this person. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And to think about that, it's just like, well, one, it makes my skin crawl. And two, what makes me so pissed off about this is when you have like pickup artist communities that teach folks how to charmingly manipulate someone into a situation where then they can actively dehumanize them because that's where they get their power rush. Like, it's, oh my God, it just makes me like ragey and also disgusted and like stomach turny and And like, I just want to make sure that everyone listening, right, no matter who you are in the world and what country you live in, this is not ever okay. Like, whether you're doing it because you're afraid of the conversation or you're doing it because you genuinely are just a piece of shit, you want to dehumanize them and objectify them and do these terrible things. Like, it's just not okay on any level to do this. And I think like what's frustrating so many people is that in the comments, like never read the comments, I know, but like in the comments for so many of these articles are just tons and tons and tons of people defending the behavior as it's not that bad. There's worse things. It's not rape, you know, and it's just kind of like this, we're trying to downplay this because it's not that bad in quotes. Right. And so like,
well, not that bad for who, right? Like, right. That's what I would say to that. It's not that bad for who. I bet none of the people who are saying that are people who've had it done to them.
Exactly.
Right. So they don't get to fucking decide how bad it is.
Yep.
That argument is also dehumanizing.
Yes. Yeah. And I think like what would be interesting is I think it was in Denmark, a man just got convicted of rape for removing a condom during sex. And, which I think is wonderful. You know, I mean, if you do that,
that
you
was
should be
one convicted. Of the charges against Julian Assange, involved condomless penetration when she had said you have to use a condom. I don't remember if he actually stealth, like, started the condom and took it off, or if there was some other type of shenanigans, but something in that neighborhood anyway.
Yeah. I part of me feels like, I mean, just considering, right, like, Brock Turner cases and, like, what poor Kesha had to go through, and part of me just doesn't have any faith in the justice system here in the United States that we would actually convict someone for that behavior, but to me, it seems so clear that is absolutely something that should have consequences for someone. But like you said earlier, you know, when we start talking about rules and laws and regulations and legislation, like there's just so much that's being missed and kind of mislegislated and or just plain overlooked and ignored.
Well, and we can make there be consequences whether the law is with us or not. And the justice system, certainly the prison system, you know, it's really complicated, and we can talk about the justice system when it comes to rape if you want to, but it's deeply fraught. Mm-hmm. But that doesn't mean that we as a culture can't decide, like, this behavior is sexual assault, and if you engage in it, you are ostracized, right? Like, if you know one of your friends or somebody in your social circles has been accused of doing this, or maybe is coming out proudly and saying, sure, I do this, I don't see why it's a problem, you know, like, there can be social consequences. You know, it doesn't have to be this person is arrested and convicted and locked up or nothing. Right. We have a lot of control in our communities as to how we treat people and what kind of privileges and intimacies and, you know, welcome we give people in our communities. So, you know, if you see people saying this on somebody's Facebook page or, you know, wherever you come across it, all of us can play a part in making this clearly not okay and making there be consequences for doing it. Just like Holly did very bravely. And it doesn't mean that she doesn't feel violated. It doesn't erase the violation, but like the fact that she drew that bright line and didn't, I'm sure he was tried to tell her it was no big deal. Right. Like, and she did not let him confuse her. And she said, nope, it's over. We're done. Fuck you. Right. And I feel like those bright lines need to get drawn over and over and over again. And we have to have each other's backs when we draw them too.
Yeah. I just love like all of the work people are doing around like transformative justice and like community oriented justice that requires all of us to take accountability for the conversations that we're having, the people that are in our lives, and like holding each other and ourselves accountable for when we do shitty things or when we know people who do shitty things. Like, it's our responsibility to actually say, like, that's not okay. That's really shitty. And to like, I think more importantly is like, how do we as communities, whether it's, you know, education communities or kink communities or whatever kinds of communities you're a part of, to like really have these conversations around what do we do when this happens? And maybe it's
I can't be friends with you anymore. Or maybe it's, we're going to stay friends, but you know what? We're going to be having some really tough conversations because this isn't okay. And I think like we all need to kind of start thinking about those in different ways, because I think that's where the real change happens.
I mean, and I would say in those kinds of processes that you want to be as victim or survivor centered as possible. So I actually really feel like we should defer to the person most directly harmed, right? So I'm thinking of a friend of mine who has an abusive ex, and it is incredibly painful to her that some of her friends have stayed friends with him. And whether or not they've had intense accountability conversations with him, like, it's really hard for her, and it's really a continued violation for her that they're still friends with him. And I think that, you know, ultimately she should be able to say, you know, if you're talking about mutual friends, like, no, like, that is actually not what I want, is for you to stay friends with him and have a stern talking to with him, right? Like,
yeah.
So I think that you can have a stern talking to you with somebody, but I think consequences are consequences. Mm-hmm. And I have equally, well, not equally, equally is false, but I also have concerns about transformative justice when it comes to sexual violation, because we know that perpetrators, a lot of them are real good about talking the talk and then going ahead and violating other people, right?
Yep.
There's a lot of gaslighting going on. You know, there's a lot of emotional manipulation, and these processes also can sometimes require the victim to do a bunch of emotional labor that they maybe don't want to do. And there can wind up being pressure for them to ultimately forgive if they don't want to forgive. So I don't think I have any magic answers in terms of accountability, right? Like, I don't know. I'm not saying you shouldn't do this or you shouldn't do that. I'm saying all the systems that I know for accountability have flaws that concern me, and I also don't know better systems. Like, that's a big, messy area for me of giant question mark and continued research and exploration. But I would caution people who think, well, I had a conversation with that person and now they understand what they did wrong. I'm not saying you can't ever do that because life is so circumstantial, but like, sometimes people who do this shit, like, they just are good talkers.
Yep.
I would be much more concerned about what the survivor wants.
Yeah. I find myself in the same kind of place of quandary, right? Like, as a rape survivor myself, I have super big feelings about, like, the folks who have done things to me being welcomed into communities and, you know, being leaders. And, like, that just makes me want to throw up. But, like, at the same time, I also have kind of this like question mark, just like you said, of like, how do we start creating a space? Like, part of me feels like we just need to like start with younger generations and do better, because we kind of are already just too fucked up where we are now. But, you know, how do we create accountability practices that, one, center survivors and victims, and two, how do we actually make space for people who have either like genuinely made mistakes or have just been real total assholes and abusers to like actually work through those things? Because, like, you know, I think the fear is if we just keep saying like, no, you're an abuser, you don't have access. No, you're an abuser, you don't have access. Then we have this big giant island of abusers, and like, we just kind of create these camps where either abusers go other places and do more things and they never have a chance to actually like come have that reckoning. But we can't rely on victims and survivors to be the ones that like kind of force them into that reckoning. So like, it is this big, huge question mark space. And I don't think any of us have answers yet. But
I think one of the reasons that nobody has answers is because there's little to no funding for researching what real rehabilitation means when it comes to sexual violence.
Yeah.
There's a little bit of research on sort of domestic abuse, separate from sexual violence, although that sometimes involves sexual violence. But there's almost nothing that's sort of reliable and replicable and peer-reviewed about what it would mean to actually rehabilitate someone so they have a significantly decreased odds of reoffending. Like, what's an actual effective method of rehabilitating someone who's a offended sexually. I think that there probably are ways, right? Like, I think there must be, I believe that, but, we have not prioritized that, you know.
Yeah.
This gets into like the March for Science and, you know, research funding. It's not a very sexy area for funding. And it also makes, you know, let's be real, the dudes in charge of the money uncomfortable.
Yeah.
So I feel like we don't have answers for systemic reasons also,
yes.
Right? That all of these giant, messy, horrible question marks, like, I bet a lot of them have answers, mm-hmm. you know, if we had the actual resources to research them. You know, my ideal answer would be that we would know what works in most cases, and we would fund programs that adhere to those standards that are shown to work,
yeah.
to rehabilitate.
Right.
But in the meantime, I'm hella skeptical of people who just say, you know, like, time has passed, and therefore I am rehabilitated.
Right. Yeah, I agree, because, you know, what's so tricky about it is culturally we've kind of painted this picture of what a monster looks like. So, mm-hmm. you know, rapists are these people who like hide in bushes and jump out and rape people, and like they're evil and they don't have like it's, you can always tell the bad guy, right? And so nobody wants to be the monster or the bad guy. But in reality, so many people who are abusing and gaslighting and manipulating and coercing are people who have really lovely attributes to them and who are smart and intelligent and have friends and family who love them, but they're swimming in this cultural soup that tells them they get to prioritize their pleasure over someone else's humanity, or who tells them when someone's super drunk, that's the best time to get a yes, because when you get rejected, then all your friends make fun of you, you know? And so like, we have these like black and white, of course, because we're a world that loves binaries, of kind of like monster or not. And you know, it makes it really difficult when we have people who like are genuinely doing good work in the world, who are like caring individuals and have wonderful relationships with people, and at the same time have abusive behaviors in certain relationships, or who manipulate people without realizing they're manipulating them, and use their bodies and use their partner's bodies, you know, for their own personal gain. And like, that's just such a nuanced, tough thing to start picking apart, because that like goes back to you at a fundamental level. And like, that can't be a single conversation, and that can't
I have to say, I am skeptical that there are mass numbers of people who don't know that they're being abusive, who are being abusive. Like, you can always find exceptions that prove the rule. But if you look at the research, it shows that most people who rape, most of them are men, if we're talking about adult and teen victims and not child abuse, which is a different dynamic, that most of them know they don't have consent, right? Like, they may not be using the word rape to think about what they're doing, but
yes. They
know what's going on, right? Like, I don't think there are a lot of people who manipulate without knowing they're manipulative, right? Like, I honestly have to express skepticism about that. And just because they have other good attributes, I agree, like, it makes it really difficult for us to recognize, you know, when we think that rapists are monsters in the bushes, it's hard to, that plays into victim blaming, because we think, oh, well, he can't be a rapist because he's clearly not a monster from the bushes. He has these other nice qualities. Mm-hmm. I absolutely agree we have to address that narrative, but I do think you're letting people off the hook for their actions a little bit too much.
I think part of where what I'm thinking of, and maybe it's just too broad, or maybe, you know, I love what you just said, but I'm kind of thinking like, what about when you're in situations of, you've been married for 20, 25 years and you've been told like, when you're married, sex is part of it. And so you just kind of like casually pressuring a spouse into like, hey, it's been a while, it's time. And if they don't, then you get passive aggressive and shitty. And like, to me, that all is part of this same thing. Now, you might not be like, you're going to have sex with me, whether you want it or not, but it's just kind of these like subtle social pressures and power dynamics, right?
We are all shaped by social dynamics. We are all shaped by the culture. But there are plenty of people who were raised in that same culture and got those same messages who don't do that in their marriages. So we also have to hold people responsible for the way that they respond to and interrogate social pressures, right? Mm-hmm. I don't consider it a factor to let people off the hook or claim ignorance, right? Yeah. I understand that there's pressure to do that, and also you're a person with volition. Both are true. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. Oh my God. This is like so juicy, and I love it, and it's making me think about so many things. Okay, so I want to kind of continue in this space because, you know, I think one of the things that, like, ultimately what we're talking about is, like, you do know right from wrong, and you do know when you're pressuring someone, and it might be uncomfortable to confront that in yourself, but, you know, we also kind of have these movements around, like, you just recently wrote something around, like, sexual assault awareness isn't enough. And I think this is another place where, like, we are kind of having, like, these surface level conversations that make us feel better, but we're not seeing enough change happen. And you were talking about how awareness isn't enough anymore. Everybody's aware of these issues. Everybody is aware that it's systemic, and everybody is aware that they exist. What we need is we actually need anger. We need accountability. We need actual change. And since we're right at the end of April, which is Sexual Assault Awareness Month, you know, and I think that kind of ties in with some of what we're talking about here of, like, you know, I think I'm being too generous, and I think that you're bringing up some, like, really wonderful, powerful points, but, like, how do we move from this, like, awareness to actual accountability when we're talking about these things? And, you know, it might just be that there's still question marks here and that's where we end up, but I'd love to know kind of, like, what got you to the place of writing that, and what do you think is next?
Oh God, honestly, I've been saying that for years, muttering it under my breath mostly. So I just finally got around to writing it because I was finished my book, I think. But, I make money in Sexual Assault Awareness Month. Colleges hire me, and I go talk under that umbrella all the time. And that might have been part of what took me so long to write that out loud also. What it reminds me of, have you watched The Handmaid's Tale, the first three episodes yet?
No, not yet. I'm skeptical. No, I'm so worried it's going to trigger the fuck out of me.
Oh, it may trigger the fuck out of you. I didn't know which part you were skeptical about. I can assure you it is very high quality, but it is very intense and may trigger the fuck out of you. I'm not telling you, you have to watch it. But there's this scene that's in the book, but it takes place in the series at the end, I think it was the end of the first episode, where, so for those who are unfamiliar, I'll do a little very basic setup, which is The Handmaid's Tale is a dystopia where a theocratic organization or force has taken over the United States, and there's a lot of infertility for reasons which are not explained in the TV show, and so I'm not going to spoil things for people. And so that women who are still fertile are basically forced into sex slavery in order to bear children for the powerful men in the new regime. And so, of course, as part of that, they are repeatedly raped. It's what they're there for, is to be repeatedly raped until they bear children. And you see this happen. Of course, nobody calls it rape. It's given this sort of, like, very formal ceremony, and, like, it's hyper normalized, mm-hmm. right? But then at the end of this first episode, all of the handmaids, which is the name of the class of sex slaves, right? Mm-hmm. Are summoned to this outdoor field sort of thing and presented with this guy who the authorities tell them is a rapist, that he actually raped a handmaid. And you're given to understand that he's not one of the people who are legally allowed to own these women, right? Mm-hmm. He acted outside the bounds of the culture that the culture has defined. And so we treat this rapist as outrageous, right? Like, everyone's like, oh, he's a rapist. And then basically he's given to the handmaids to beat to death, which they do. And then everyone feels sort of spleened in this community. They feel like, oh, well, we identified a rapist in our midst and we gave him our form of justice. And so this is clearly a culture that takes rape seriously and has zero tolerance for it. Mm-hmm. And it just, like, couldn't be a better metaphor for what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
Which is, like, this culture runs on rape, right? Like, rape baked into the institutions, but nobody wants to acknowledge that. That's institutionally denied and papered over in every way. In order so that people don't get antsy, we say like, well, this over here, this one case, this is a legitimate rape. I use that phrase advisedly. Right. And so we're going to take this so seriously that it involves the most brutal possible death penalty. And now we're a culture that takes rape seriously. Everyone's aware, right? Like, and so that's how I feel about Sexual Assault Awareness Month is like, we're going to actually, when people say, everyone you meet will say, of course, rape is bad and should be taken seriously. But what rapes do they see, right, as valid? And what rape are they not paying attention to that's much more socially sanctioned or socially acceptable? And what are we doing about it? Once a year, we all have some awareness events and we wear denim and we did a thing about rape and we can go back about our business and not think about it and, let the institutions of rape continue to function. That scene just like, it was just, I haven't stopped thinking about it since I watched it. Look, that scene aside, because obviously I don't support beating anyone to death under any circumstances.
just have to say that.
Just for the record, in case anyone's misunderstanding me. I do feel like, some of the things that get done under the Sexual Assault Awareness Month umbrella are good, right? Like, it's good to talk about some of the things that people have programs about. But when we keep doing that 101 level over and over again and don't push past it to the uncomfortable parts where we hold our institutions actually accountable and people have to take responsibility for themselves and for their communities in ways that are really uncomfortable and difficult to confront, like, we're not fucking getting anywhere, right?
Yeah.
Again, like, sexual assault, I said this in the piece, but Sexual Assault Awareness Month is so safe and non-controversial that our president, who is most likely a rapist, right, has been accused by more than a dozen women of sexual assault, felt perfectly comfortable declaring it Sexual Assault Awareness Month, right? Yeah. That should tell us everything we need to know.
Yeah.
And I don't know the answers about accountability. We had that conversation, but what if every institution that's been complicit in covering up sexual violence had to cough up big dollars during Sexual Assault Accountability Month to fund that research that I wish existed,
Yes.
We could actually get somewhere. What if it was Sexual Assault Action Month and we really thought about what kind of actions would get us closer to what our goals are? I think that my real objection is to awareness as a goal instead of as a tactic. When we say we're raising awareness and we just leave it at that, like, that's treating awareness as the end goal and it's getting us nowhere. It's sometimes perfectly appropriate that you have to raise awareness of something in order to make people want to take action about it. But then you have to help people take action, right? Like, you can't just leave it at awareness, right? Like,
yeah.
We had to raise awareness that marital rape was wrong in order to make it illegal. It took several decades to outlaw it in all 50 states. And I think the last state outlawed it sometime in the 90s, which is still shocking when I think about it, how recent that was. But in my lifetime, it's been legal to rape your wife in some states in this country. Mm-hmm. And actually when I was born, it was legal in most, if not all of them. So, absolutely that involved raising awareness to make that shift, but it didn't just involve raising awareness. Like, we had to then make legislation.
Yeah.
And make people pass it.
Do you think that part of the reason we haven't moved past awareness is because people are so terrified of being controversial and also are so terrified of the discomfort of getting things wrong and not really knowing and kind of having to be in those question marks that it's just safer to just kind of stand at the edge and say, like, let's all look at this really terrible thing and talk about it, but let's not go any further because that might be way too uncomfortable and scary and ostracize the money and all that kind of stuff?
I mean, I'm going to sound like a conspiracy theorist, and I promise you I'm not. But I think the reason is in part because the really powerful institutions in this country are run by men, and men think that that accountability for rape, a lot of men, not all men, hashtag not all men, a lot of men are really afraid of accountability for rape because they, maybe in their heart of hearts, don't know that they've always treated women as fully human. They don't know if it's going to come around for them or their buddies, or if it's going to violate the bro code. And those attitudes are deeply entrenched and hard to figure out how to fight. So part of it is like, it's really hard to figure out how to do it also. Yeah. And you know, we all want those things that make us feel accomplished that are easy. It's, you know, it's like a little candy dispenser. And I do think, and I think this is maybe what you were trying to get out early, and I might have been a little too hard on you, but I do think about those guys who maybe when they hear talk about affirmative consent, think, well, if that's true, then I'm a rapist, right? Mm-hmm. Like, if affirmative consent really is the correct moral standard, what does that mean about me and my morals?
Yeah.
And, I think we have to figure out what to do for those guys to encourage them to come in from the cold. Yeah. Right? Because our options are just be like, yeah, well, fuck you, which is satisfying emotionally, right?
Yes.
You should have thought of that earlier. I'm so terribly sorry that you didn't, but you didn't. But then they don't come around, right? Or we make it too easy and say, you know, oh, it doesn't matter what happened in the past. What matters is what you do in the future, which is also not true. And is super disrespectful to whomever they've already hurt.
Yeah.
And so figuring out that middle path, right, in which we say there has to be accountability. And what does that accountability and rehabilitation look like?
Right.
But also, and it gets back to that monster issue, right? Like, maybe you have hurt someone, like it, but it, maybe if we didn't think of rapists as monsters, it would be easier to say, wow, I hurt someone, and not, wow, I'm a monster.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I've talked about this a number of times, and I think it's important to talk about, right? And it's a mild thing, but like, I grew up in the 90s and graduated from high school in the mid 90s. And like, I didn't ever really have anyone talk to me about consent until I started taking kink workshops, like in my late 20s. And like, I of course knew, like, don't pressure people and things like that, because by that point I had been sexually assaulted, but you know, like, just those nuanced conversations. And I remember this one time I was dancing in a bar with a woman that I thought was super hot, and we were making out, and I didn't know what was supposed to happen next. And so I just assumed, based on everything that I knew about like sex and movies and things like that, that like the next thing to do was just to like start touching her breasts without asking, because we were making out. And of course, like, after making out is like you touch people above their clothes. And so like I did that, and I remember she was like, I'm really not ready for that. And then like I felt terrible because I didn't ask her ahead of time. I just did it. And then we had this super awkward moment. And of course I stopped, but you know, like, I just kind of think about that of like, I think there are spaces where we genuinely aren't sure what to do. And so we do the wrong thing. And maybe we do that multiple times.
Decent people also pay attention when they get those no cues.
Yes.
And even, I mean, I feel like I'm going to make this assumption about you, and you tell me if I'm wrong. I think even if she hadn't said no explicitly, but if she had sort of frozen up and stopped dancing with you or stopped participating, you also would have stopped.
Yes.
It would have been cleaner. And so, right. Look, it's not ideal that you did that, but also you stopped, right? Like, and I'm talking about people who didn't stop, because technically nobody was saying no, maybe.
Exactly. What I think feels really satisfying is just like, fuck you. I don't want to deal with you. Like, you're a jerk. You did this terrible thing. But then there's the part of me that's like the educator that wants to build the bridges of like, how do we kind of open these conversations up? And how do we use language that gets people who otherwise would be like, no, that's not me, I'm not a monster, to actually start saying like, maybe I've done some things that have really hurt some people. And then how do we go take the conversation one step further from that, right? And like, that might feel really shitty and not satisfying, but like, those are kind of the spaces that I am playing in right now. But I'm glad you were hard on me earlier, and I'm glad you said those things, because they're super thought-provoking and important. And, you know, I think like all those conversations need to happen. And that's, I think inherently, that's what people are trying to avoid, is that exact discomfort, right? And like, no, let's be in that discomfort. Let's call each other out and say like, no, I think you're being too easy, or maybe I've been too hard. And like, I think these are the conversations, the exact conversations we need to be having to even try to start getting to some of those question marks.
Yeah, but I think in that, I think it's clarifying to remember that most guys, even cis guys who have been raised in this culture, don't sexually assault anyone.
Yeah.
That's always sort of the clarifying and grounding thing for me to remember, right? Yeah. So, yes, the culture is powerful, but also most guys aren't rapists, right? Mm-hmm. And most women, most people of all genders don't rape anyone. So, you know, we absolutely have to shift the culture so it's less fertile to me. It's less encouraging for people who have those impulses, but we also have to hold people who hurt other people responsible for their actions. Right.
Absolutely.
And we also have to sort of get rid of intention altogether to a certain extent. Like, you know, if I decide to drive drunk and I hurt someone with the car, like, I'm responsible for that, whether I wanted to hurt that person or not. I still hurt that person. And so I just feel like good intentions don't get you very far when you've hurt someone. I don't think they do.
I mean, I think we can have conversations around them, but I don't think that's where we need to be making our decisions. Like, we can talk that you didn't mean to hurt somebody and what that feels like for you, but, like, you hurt someone, and so now we actually need to talk about the person that is hurt and how we move to healing for them or support for them. And like, that's a uncomfortable place to be, but I think you're absolutely right. Like, it doesn't matter whether or not I meant to, I did. And so now where are we, and now what's next? And that, more people are starting to kind of realize like intention doesn't matter, but I don't think enough people are starting to get there or are there yet.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know if I'd go so far to say intention doesn't matter at all. I tend to say intentions aren't magic.
Yeah. Right?
Like, they don't make the harm not have occurred.
Right.
It may be useful to understand people's intentions in understanding if we had some actual research, like how to help them not reoffend, right? Like, maybe depending on what your intentions are, the approach is different, but the accountability should, you know, still be there regardless of what you meant.
Yeah.
You know, I didn't know. It's just not an adequate excuse for harming someone in that way. Mm-hmm. It's your responsibility to know.
It is your responsibility to know.
And most everyone pulls it off.
Yeah. Yes. Yes. And I do think like, that's just, I think sometimes like when we hear conversations around like rape and sexual assault and trauma and healing, like sometimes it can feel a little bit hopeless, but I love that you keep bringing it back to like, most people don't harm other people. Most people know, wow, this doesn't feel very good. This person doesn't want this. I'm stopping. And so just kind of like remembering that, like, genuinely, for the most part, like, all of us really are trying to do our best, and we might make small mistakes, but, you know, most of us do know how to do this. And so what we're talking about is a smaller subset, and not like every single human being, like in The Handmaid's Tale, right?
Yeah. I mean, look, most of us can use advancement in our sexual citizenship, right? Like, we can be better and more responsible in terms of like really seeing the humanity of our partners and respecting it. It's not like we don't all have things to learn, but most of us also are invested in whether or not our partner's okay and having a good time. You know, just instinctually, we may not have the tools to talk about it. And we can, so I certainly talk to students about that. And, we may, you know, we may need reframing in our brains, but you would have stopped with that woman. You really would have, even if she didn't say no, I believe that. Because it just wouldn't have felt right because you're not turned on by overpowering someone.
Right.
Like genuinely, I'm not talking about kinks. I'm talking about like,
right, like genuinely dominating
someone. Yes. So yeah, but I kind of, can we talk about the role of pleasure in this?
Oh, please do.
I know we're running out of time, but I don't want to like leave everybody in such a bleak place.
Yeah, pleasure.
So here's what I've been thinking about a ton lately. I've been thinking about, I actually just yesterday gave an interview to a journalist about the Steubenville, Ohio gang rape. Do you know this story?
Yes.
Okay. You don't even need to know the story to understand this anecdote. There were high school kids, two boys dragged a girl who was so drunk that she was slipping in and out of consciousness. They dragged her from location, party to party, and violated her in a variety of ways. And there were bystanders, their football buddies were there, and nobody did anything. And they just cheered them on, right? And when asked on the stand during the trial why he didn't intervene, one of the bystanders said, "I didn't know that's what rape looked like. I didn't know I was looking at a rape," is basically what he said. Mm-hmm. And that stuck with me for so long because he's basically saying, well, what was he looking at? He was looking at a young woman laying passively, being acted on sexually, being consumed by two buddies of his who are guys, right? Mm-hmm. Well, that's the basic root idea of the commodity idea of sexuality that is the dominant idea that most of us grow up in, right? Yeah. That, like, women are the sexual product and men are the consumers, you know, or the buyers, depending on, you know, which language we're using in this gross sexual marketplace metaphor, right? That's what he thinks sex is supposed to look like, literally. And what's more, and getting back to your point about monsters, right? He sees that these are his buddies. They're not monsters. So, of course, they're not rapists, right? Like, he likes them. They have great qualities.
Yep.
And I contrast that with the Brock Turner case that made all the headlines last year.
Yeah.
Where two guys came along, a very similar scene of a guy sexually acting upon, sexually consuming a passed out passive woman who's not actively participating. This was at Stanford. And those two guys said, "This scene looks horrible and wrong and we must intervene in immediately." Do you know what the difference is between those two situations?
I would love for you to tell me. I mean, I'm sure there's many, but
yeah.
You have a point.
Well, there's many. The key one here for me is those guys who intervened in the Brock Turner rape, they're from Sweden.
Yeah.
They were raised in Sweden. In Sweden, you get sex ed integrated into the curriculum every year, starting in kindergarten, and they teach you about affirmative consent, and they center humanity and healthy sexuality and respect for your partners. And there's so much less shame and stigma around sex in general that they know what healthy sexual interaction is supposed to look like. They know what enthusiasm and pleasure is supposed to look like, and they know what it looks like when it's absent. And they know that women are expected to like sex and be participating if they're into it, right? There's no taboo about women actually being into sex, right? So the difference between those two situations in terms of two witnesses to very similar scenes was whether or not they expected to see pleasure, right? Female pleasure.
Yeah.
And whether or not they expected to see people treating each other as humans. And so, you know, I really feel like the keystone to a ton of shifting this culture is creating a culture where female sexual pleasure is not only not taboo, but is seen as healthy, right? Yeah. It's seen as expected, so normal that its absence sets off alarm bells if you see a sexual interaction where it's not present.
Yeah.
So that sort of ties into what we were talking about in the beginning, where, like, you can't talk about these two issues without each other, right? It's not like sexual liberation is over here and anti-rape work is over there. You know, they are the same work.
Yeah.
Right? They're the same work. You can't talk about, like, making sex better for everyone without acknowledging and talking about the role that sexual violence plays in making sex not great. Mm-hmm. And you can't end sexual violence without changing the culture around our attitudes towards sexual pleasure. What constitutes pleasurable sex for all of us, but especially dealing with the taboos around women and sex.
Yeah. Oh my God. I love that. I'm so glad that you brought us from beginning to end and wrapped it up and gave us that juicy tidbit to think about. Cause I think you are so right. And pleasure is the thing that's just missing from so many of our sexual conversations, specifically in American culture and sex education. And I know we're all trying to work to change that, but boy, there's so much more to do. And it's exciting.
There's a lot to do.
There is a lot to do. And, you know, it's also exciting to think that people are, you know, reading your books and listening to your podcast and listening to this podcast and having access to even conversations like this. Because hopefully that starts conversations in their homes with their kids and with their families and all that kind of stuff. But I think you're so right. When we have a genuine understanding of what open conversation looks like, of what pleasure looks like, of what an engaged sexual exchange looks like, and we haven't grown up in a system where sex is all about performing and achieving this kind of commodity model. And instead it's exactly what you said. It's about this collaboration and genuinely seeing that this is a mutual exchange. It leads to very different results.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Well, I know that we are at the hour, and even though there were lots of other things for us to roll around in, you will be back in a couple of months to talk about your new book. And so we can go even deeper then, but I would love it if you could tell everyone how they can stay in touch with you and find you online.
Oh, sure. Absolutely. You can find me on Twitter and Facebook at Jacqueline F, J-A-C-L-Y-N-F as in Friedman. If you want to follow my sort of non-political or sex-related stuff on Insta, which is mostly food and travel and random selfies.
And I'm Jacqueline hair.
I just got my hair done. I'm really loving it.
Yeah.
I'm at Jacqueline Effable there. You can find all my work, including stuff about how to bring me to your community and my podcast Unscrewed and writing and all of that stuff at jacquelinefriedman.com. Friedman is F-R-I-E-D-M-A-N. And you can also obviously subscribe to my podcast Unscrewed in iTunes or Stitcher or Acast or wherever you like to get your podcasts. That probably covers all the bases.
Yay. Well, I will have all of those links on sexgetsreal.com for this episode, so everyone can click through and follow you and buy your books and book you for talks and all that good stuff.
Yay!
Yeah. Thank you so much for coming on the show and offering all of these amazing, juicy, rich conversations and tidbits. My brain is buzzing. I love it.
Oh, it was super. I hate to say that it was super fun because that makes me sound like a sociopath, but... It was actually really great to talk to you. I was glad to do it.
Listeners get it. Well, thank you. I had so much fun too. And also to all of our listeners, if you have other questions on these topics, you have questions for Jacqueline, she will be back in a couple of months. So I can hold on to those questions for us to roll around in them. If you have questions or stories about anything else, all you have to do is go to sexgetsreal.com and you can submit a question via the contact form. We would love to hear from you. So thank you so much. And I will talk to you next week.